Since the mid-1970s, Hmong men, women, and children have been coming to the United States to avoid persecution in their homelands. Within the U.S., Wisconsin has the third highest concentration of Hmong families, which are dispersed among cities like Milwaukee, Madison, Wausau, La Crosse, and of course, Eau Claire. This hour, we'll welcome on members of the community in Eau Claire to ask them about their history, the challenges they've faced in settling and growing up in the U.S., and how they're keeping their traditions and culture alive. It's the second in a three-part series of programs where we're focusing on immigrant populations in our region. This is The West Side. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'd like to introduce my guests, and first, I'd like to welcome John Lohr. John is the president of the Eau Claire Area Mutual Assistance Association. John Lohr, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Next, I'd like to introduce Chu Zhang, who was the first Hmong person to be elected to the Eau Claire Area School Board this year. Chu, thank you for taking the time as well.
Thank you for inviting me.
Our pleasure. And also joining us this hour, our student representative Chua Zhang and assistant anthropology professor Ari Anand. Chua and Ari, thank you both for being here as well, and we'll get to the very exciting Hmong Studies Initiative, but thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Thank you. And listeners, we would like to hear from you this hour. Are you a Hmong, first or second generation Hmong American, and if so, what has it been like living in a Midwestern town like Eau Claire, or a city like Eau Claire? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-228-5615. The phone lines are wide open, and we can take your calls all hour long. Also, if you have a question or comment and you would rather not call in, you can go on Facebook and look for The West Side. So I'd like to start with you, John. And when did the first wave of Hmong refugees start arriving in the Eau Claire area? And did they come straight to Eau Claire, or was it kind of bouncing around within the U.S.?
The first Hmong family came back in the 1978 directly to Eau Claire. Is Jean Gaimore. He's the first family came to Eau Claire. It's sponsorship by church in this community area.
Okay. And was that the case with a lot of families back then? Were the churches and the missionaries heavily involved in that?
Yes. And that time, we don't have any people living in this country. So when people as a refugee were to come to over to this country, we need sponsorship. So basically church sponsors a refugee family to Eau Claire. So John Guy is the first family came to Eau Claire.
And what were some of the early challenges? I imagine getting sponsorship was one of them, but what was it like for them maybe coming to Eau Claire, and it's such a different culture here versus back home?
Well, back in time is really difficult for our family came to over to this country because we live in the country of Laos and people is not speaking the language. And when we came over here, seemed to look like we are newborn again because we had to learn everything new, adapt to a new culture in this country, and totally opposite on where we live back in Laos or Thailand.
How so? I know that it seems like the kinship and just the clan, the idea of the clan is very important there, and that's different among people that have been living in the U.S.
Clan leader in Hmong always believe that clan leader is important to the family because we are, doesn't matter where you go, same last name, we consider we are cousin. In the Hmong traditional, we cannot marry as same last names. So we keep clan leader is very important in the Hmong families.
Okay. And the language barriers, when the first families were coming here, I imagine there weren't any Hmong mutual assistance associations at the time. Was the language, is that one of the biggest challenges for non-English speaking, I imagine?
Yes, I remember that John Kai, we have a workshop together and we were talking about, he said when we first came to this country, then speaking the language and even they put food into the refrigerator and close it and he didn't know how to go open it, and they're really hungry until their family member came back and say, why don't you eat the food? And he said, where the food is, and you put it in here. And then he thought it locked already in there, so nobody opened it, no one know how to do it. So we living back in Laos, we had no electricity, we had no refrigerator, stove, everything that we cook or water, we need to go get from the stream. So that's why totally opposite.
And yourself, were you born in this country?
No, I came from the refugee camp in Thailand straight to Auckland back in 1989.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the refugee camp, that a lot of people, including myself, probably don't know that there was a movement of people from Laos to Thailand. And what was it like? Do you remember what it was like living in the refugee camp?
Yeah, in the refugee camp in Thailand, it's a very small space, a lot of people because space limited. And we live in there with 3,000 or 4,000 Hmong family live in a very small area. And we are really cloud in there. You know, it's really suffering back in the refugee camp, you know.
Now, when was the Eau Claire Area Hmong Mutual Assistance Association created, and why?
The Hmong Mutual Assistance in Eau Claire is created back in the 1980. The reason is Hmong population came to Eau Claire, and we think that it's a good idea to have Hmong association organization available for the Hmong people because when they need it, we can hire somebody that in there to help them as a translator, interpreter, finding a job for them or educating them how to live the life in this country. So that's why we create the Hmong associations.
All right. And were they there are Hmong mutual assistance associations in Eau Claire, La Crosse, pretty much every city where there's a major population. Which were the first? It was the first in maybe in Milwaukee and Madison, the larger cities, or
I think that they created in back in the I think the Milwaukee is the first one because of the larger populations,
yeah.
And then breaking down into small community because when each community have a population in there and they need a place to need help, so we need that's why we expanded to 12 different cities that we have Hmong associations in the state of Wisconsin.
And I'm wondering, for the folks that first moved here, I mean, maybe even prior to the Hmong Mutual Assistance Association being created, was there any kind of pushback from the white majority community? Was there any discrimination or anything like that?
I think at the beginning, yes, because it's since we came over to this country, we have different color, different skin. The white population is dominant, the minority, and we have that prejudice back then. But since we were population growing up every year, and now we get that squared away.
Very good. What about the younger folks here? Chu, I'll go to you next, and then I want to ask Chua too. Have you noticed any of that growing up? Were you born in the U.S.?
No, I was born in Ban V Nai refugee camp, Block 2.
Block 2.
Yes.
Represent, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed when you came to the U.S., was there any discrimination or people that just didn't understand?
Well, it's getting better. It used to be where I lived in on Hobart when I first moved into Eau Claire. I used to walk down to the parks, the local park, and I will get comments, you know, go back to your country or, you know, just dirty looks. And now I don't get so much of that. But when I was running my campaign for the school board, I had a friend, a Cuban friend that was helping me out. He was passing out some of my flyers. It was getting late, about 7 o'clock-ish. They called the cop on him, you know. Just because he was in a predominantly white neighborhood, I don't walk after 7 o'clock because I'm afraid something like that is going to happen. And we've seen it on the news where, you know, trigger-happy people decided they want to be the hero of their neighborhood and, you know, they do things. And my car, you know, I had a sign, you know, vote Chu Zhong on my car. And it got egged, you know, and it has never gotten, none of my cars has gotten egged before. So it leads me to think that running for this position was getting...
You're almost putting too much in their face or something?
I feel that is true to a point, but then again, it could just be a kid with nothing else better to do.
Right. Chua, what about yourself? I remember hearing last winter there was an incident at the campus, and Ari, if you want to jump in too, where there was a pretty insensitive note that was left on a bathroom door or something like that. Have you noticed at UW-Eau Claire, or as a young person, and imagine you were born in the U.S. or you were not?
No, I was not. I would just like to say that, well, I was born in Thailand Bat Vinai refugee camp. Okay. I don't know what block, but I came here when I was around one. And so I guess I'll consider myself a refugee instead of an immigrant.
Okay.
Because a refugee is someone who comes out of will. We have to come here because we're fleeing. An immigrant, on the other hand, is someone who chooses to be here. And so I guess I'd just like to make that distinction between myself.
My apologies.
And it's okay. And I'd just like to add on to what you were saying earlier. Growing up, I haven't really noticed any aggressive racism. But I've noticed a lot of microaggression. And microaggression are things that are subtle, that makes you feel uncomfortable or unwanted. And so these things can come in multiple different forms. Like as Chu said earlier, glares, people looking, eyeing you down, and you feel out of place, out of the environment. Things like you have to represent Hmong in class. Professors or teacher mm-hmm. ask you that, so Chua, tell me, what is Hmong history? Like, well, I don't know. I'm only like 12. Okay, and then going back to what you were saying about the note on the 8th floor in Towers, this is a learning, living community for Hmong. So this is not just for Hmong students, for anybody who's interested in learning about Hmong culture, Hmong history. And so there was this note in... A lot of people don't consider it racism, but it is racism. It's a form of racism, such as like a microaggression, putting Hmong students out of place, telling them that they don't belong, telling them that they're not Americans. So that's basically what the note is. And so there has to be action.
You know, that's interesting. I never would have thought that, but I imagine being in a class where you might be the one of the only Hmong students, you're the example whenever there's anything to be discussed about that history. That's interesting. And what about pressure from the outside community to assimilate? John, was there any pressure that you noticed from the white community to try to Americanize Hmong people?
Yes and no. The reason I say that, because I think that when we adapt into this country and the white population, the dominant populations, and they're pushing us into a square, you know, to the side a little more. Mm-hmm. And then the only thing is for to make them understanding why we are here, because I think a lot of people don't know why Hmong people came to America, and they don't know that we have been back in the 1960, 1970, that our parents have been involved with the CIA fighting the war, and we came here. We're not, like Chua mentioned early, that we are not immigrant. We are refugee. We had to escape the communists into Thailand because of the helping the CIA during the war, and then that's why we are here. So when we educate the more educated white people that we are here, have a reason to be here, then they understand it. They will not push us so much.
Anyone else want to play off of that?
Yes. There's always been that notion where America is the melting pot. So mm-hmm. it from the get-go, it was assimilate or get annihilated. You know. So any kind of immigrant or refugee group that came here had to learn the language, had to drop their, almost as though they had to erase themselves and adopt this predominantly white heritage. And it became such a conflict that even nowadays they're changing it towards more of a solid bowl mm-hmm. theory versus a, you know, predominantly come here and assimilate theory. And so I think that the majority or the mainstream population is grasping this concept of uniqueness and identity and culture. But I think that there's still a lot more we can do. There's a lot more work. I don't think this assimilation or this racial thing, as Joel was saying earlier, is going to disappear anytime soon. But we are making strides, and I like to think that we are making positive change, as you know, the Hmong culture is getting more involved in the community. I myself, I am a very traditional Hmong person. I like to learn any and everything about my culture. I was never this way, because I would go to school, and my teachers, my educators, the people I look up to, will be telling me pretty much everything I'm learning is, what I know is wrong. Mm. You know, and so when you come back, you don't want to learn these things. You know, your parents are teaching you these things that are not written anywhere. And in school, if it's not written, it's not right. It's not true. You know, and the Hmong culture has never, the written language didn't get to where it was until the 1950s. Mm. All right? And let's see. And after that, it wasn't even used. It was adopted and used mainly after the war, where the Hmong community was separated, because we are such a tight-knit group that, you know, we live in the same little village. If you want to talk to grandma, send Johnny over to get grandma. That's pretty much it. There's no written notes. There's no mail system. And now where one person's living in South America, the other one is in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to get the written language. We had to adopt it, and that's when it started to get widely used. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Ari. Adding on to some of the comments, and specifically I think responding to your question about the pressure to assimilate, I think this connects to what both you and Joe are talking about, is I think, you know, when we think about pressure to assimilate, it isn't as if there's some sort of self-conscious attempt. There might be that, but there's also pressure at policy levels, right? So when we're talking about going to school, as Chu was saying, there are certain forms of being and certain forms of knowing that are valued and that are seen as the American way. And at a policy level, then, being Hmong is not supported, right? There's no Hmong language instruction, for instance, provided. We don't have bilingual instruction. So there's that pressure, right, which is not, it's not as if you can point to anyone's bad motive here.
Sure.
But there's a policy in place that is problematic in some way. But then it gets more complicated, because it actually places students in an impossible situation. Because we also, while we value this so-called American way, we value something called multiculturalism. It gets to the uniqueness point. So then you have students in college, or probably in school too. My experience in the U.S. is at the college level. Mm-hmm. Is where a Hmong student might be the only one or two Hmong students in class, and they're told to represent all Hmong people and represent so-called multiculturalism and diversity. And so the teacher will say, well, here we have a Hmong person. Why don't you tell us about your traditions and your culture? Well, this is an impossible position for this child or the student, because they've never been taught this stuff, right? You've been systematically alienated from your language, your traditions, for years and years and years of schooling. Mm-hmm. And now suddenly the burden is upon you to not only know all this, but represent all other people. So I think it's a very difficult, it's emotionally and psychologically difficult. It's a challenge for learning, right? And all this is happening at policy levels, right? So there's a kind of, this is, I think, what we call structural racism, where it's mm-hmm. not, you know, it isn't as if there's, you know, a bigoted person being nasty. But the policies and structures we have in place lend themselves to this kind of very discriminatory sort of effect on different students.
Basically, there is one way, and then all else is different.
We won't support that other way. On mm-hmm. the other hand, we expect you to
right.
to teach us that other way.
Very interesting.
Because we are, after all, supposedly multicultural. So you see the contradiction.
Right.
Yeah.
We're talking about the Hmong American experience. We've got a panel of guests, including John Lohr, president of the Eau Claire Area Hmong Mutual Assistance Association, Chu Jiang, who was recently elected in April to the Eau Claire Area School Board, the first Hmong person elected to the school board. We've also got Ari Anand. He's an assistant professor of anthropology at UW-Eau Claire, and Chu Jiang, student representative on the Hmong Studies Steering Committee. Both Ari and Chua are involved in this really cool thing, which we're going to talk about in just a bit, to create a Hmong Studies program at UW-Eau Claire. The number is 1-800-228-5615. We've got a lot of great guests. We've got wide open phone lines. Give us a call. Let us know what you think. The number is 1-800-228-5615. And also, if there's anyone in the Hmong community that would like to tell us your story, please feel free to do so. Also, you can check out the Westside Facebook page and leave a comment or a question there, and we'll be sure to get it on the air. This is the West Side, by the way. Let's take our first break, actually. When we get back, I want to talk about, we've been talking about the assimilation or the pressure to assimilate or the structural type of racism out there, but I want to learn about how families and individuals maintain their cultural identity. So we'll talk about that when we get back. This is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from AFS Intercultural Programs, supported through funding from the U.S. State Department, recruiting host families for high school students from around the world. Information at afsusa.org.
I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the Hmong American experience in Eau Claire and western Wisconsin and the U.S. as a whole, I guess. We've got four guests with us today, including John Lohr. He's the president of the Eau Claire Area Hmong Mutual Assistance Association. We've also got Ari Anand, assistant professor of anthropology at UW-Eau Claire. Chua Zhang, student representative at UW-Eau Claire, who is also pushing with Ari to create a Hmong studies program there. And Chu Zhang, recently elected to the Eau Claire Area School Board. We've been talking about, you know, the pressures of assimilation or the pressures of the just within the U.S. to kind of you know conform to what is the quote-unquote American experience. But what about keeping Hmong cultural identity? How important is that? And I'll start with you, John Lohr.
Keeping Hmong traditional is very important. The reason I say that keeping Hmong traditional is important because we are the culture is the one that keep up this very close family together. Doesn't matter where you go, the culture need to continue. Even myself, I always say I have four children. That I always say that Hmong traditional is totally different than any other culture. I said probably we live in Eau Claire for a long time, and a lot of you guys might see us as culture really tied together. Mm-hmm. And as an example, like among funeral homes, you can see people come from everywhere because of the culture and the relationship of the Hmong family. So that's why we still pushing our kid to keep the traditional going on, because that's the only way to keep up who we are, where we're coming from.
I remember when when the general, Vang Pao, passed away, there was large groups of people leaving cities in Wisconsin to go to the funeral in California, and I was just really touched by that. I was really surprised, and I mean, you wouldn't see that, I think, in other cultures. I mean, so Chu Zhang, what about you? What specifically do you do to, other than you already mentioned that you like to learn everything you can about the culture? I mean, do you still are there certain things that you do or that you embrace?
Yes, I actually make time to talk to my father.
Interesting.
Because it's going back to what I said earlier, where everything is getting passed on verbally.
Mm-hmm.
There's no manuals, nothing to learn about the Hmong culture. So you, in the old country, you learn, you know, fathers teach sons, mothers teach daughters, right? And that's pretty much what we're doing here, because no one has a book. So I have to make time now. Because in old country, we just go to the garden. The family's always together. Here, I'm a full-time student. I'm on the board of education. I have a couple of odd jobs. And so I'm always gone. And being always gone, I will never have a chance to actually talk to my father if I don't make the, you know, appointments. I have to do that with everybody now. Sorry for the listeners. I make an appointment so then I can learn that why we do what we do when we do it. Mm-hmm. Like the funerals, why does it take 3-4 days? You know, because that's how long it takes to send a soul to the afterlife. You know, and there's conductors there. There's a group of people that are in charge of it. And it does not just, it cannot be done with a 2-hour wake. Or a 4-hour standby, you know, by a casket. It is actually compressed so much to where it will fit the, quote, American society, because we start on Friday and we have to end by Monday morning because everybody else has to go to work.
Hmm.
Right? It's actually compressed. And when my Caucasian friends are asking me, why do you guys do it for so long? It's because that's how long it takes. That's the minimal amount of time it takes to send that soul to the afterlife. And that is part of the respect for that person, you know.
And Chua, the same question for you. What do you do, the specific actions you take to maintain your culture? And also, I'm wondering, and I'll ask Chua and Chu, whether or not there is some differences in how much of a person embraces it between generations, like the older generation, do the younger generations, are they pushing away from the cultural identity?
Well, I think it really depends. Something that Ari talked about earlier was the institution system, how it makes us or forces us to assimilate in certain ways, right? And so I think that within certain people, I don't think it's necessarily generation, but I think it's within certain people that they tend to embrace more identity, as we put it, or not. And so it really depends. I think for me, though, it's really important for us to continue to know about our heritage. It's important for us to know about how our role are played out at the funerals, for example. One of the reasons is because because the institution makes this barrier for us to not know. And so we are forced to talk about it when times come, and because we may not be aware of it, it's important for me at least to know what Hmong means to me and how I'm going to interact with these people, because these are my family. These are the people that are important to me, and if I don't know how to interact with them, then I really don't know. So my major is critical culture studies, and one of the main things that I do in it is mainly Hmong research. So researching, trying to learn back about the things that I need to know so that I can communicate with my family members, with my community. So,
do you think there are segments of younger population, of the younger groups that are kind of fighting at all the traditions?
I think there is, and I think that's the importance of this Hmong Studies Steering Committee, is to create the Hmong Studies program so that younger students can come in and learn about Hmong history, Hmong culture, Hmong language, which are really important essentials to know about Hmong.
We'll talk about that in just a bit, I promise. We're talking about the Hmong American Experience in Eau Claire in western Wisconsin. The number to call in, 1-800-228-5615. That number again, 1-800-228-5615, if you've got a question or a comment. And I want to talk about some of the gains made by the Hmong community in Eau Claire. Political, back in 1996, Joe Bijang made history for being the first Hmong person elected to a city council in Wisconsin, I think in Wisconsin's history. And just this year, in April, Chu Zhang, you also made history by becoming the first Hmong person elected to the Eau Claire Area School Board. What does this mean for the community, for the Hmong community? Does that mean there's more acceptance happening in Eau Claire and the region?
I like to think so, because before me, there was two attempts at this seat with the district school board. They were both unsuccessful because at the time, I believe that, you know, social acceptance was not there. So they were unsuccessful because of that. But as I was running and as I was knocking on doors, like my my campaign manager, Joe, I know you're listening. he's always pushing for me to just go and knock on doors because of my personality. Right, and so as I'm knocking on doors, he was there with me a couple of times. But we'll approach a house, and they will have a stare like, "What are you doing here? What are you trying to sell me? Are you a con man?" And then as we get together and mingle, they relax, they drop their guard, and then they really get to know you. And this is when he says that I shine. This is when I make that friend or get that vote. All right, and so I don't know how it was in the past. I know the two person that ran, but I don't know how they approached it. If they went and knock on doors and talk to people the same way I did, because that's how I got the social acceptance. I truly believe that's how I got to where I am, especially with this Board of Education. I go there, I just talk, I mingle. And that's the key here. When you mingle with somebody from a different background, then you start to build that trust and that rapport. And from there, you know, anything can happen.
Now, there's some schools in the Eau Claire district that have a pretty fair percentage of Hmong children in there. Before you were elected, was this population within the district, was that being underserved or ignored?
Well, it depends on what school you go to. Yeah. I had the privilege of going to DeLong for a little while, and DeLong had a very good English as a second language mm-hmm. program. ESL, mm-hmm. and now it's just called EL. And it was very catered to the population because they had a bigger Hmong population or a bigger minority population there at the time. And then I went over to North Star. There was programs there, but it wasn't as extensive. And they did not approach me. I had to approach the people that are in charge of these programs to get these services. And being a little Hmong kid that wanted to just fit in, you know, I didn't approach anybody because I didn't want to be that person that was different. And so that was also really good because it actually forced me to be more outgoing with the Caucasian friends.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's how... you know, I bettered my English. I did a lot of these other things that these programs were designed to do by myself. Didn't know I was doing it at the time, but it helped in that I wasn't singled out. I was not put into a room with a bunch of just Hmong kids to where now I don't even know how to interact with the general population outside these rooms. You know, so ESL programs and programs like that are great. The idea of them are great. It's just sometimes it backfires.
Sure. Interesting. Now, as far as economic gains, there's there are a number of Hmong-owned businesses. And also I've read that while, you know, maybe a majority of Hmong families in Eau Claire are renting their homes, their home ownership is growing quite a bit. And John Laurie, I know you have something to do with real estate, but is that a sign of the Hmong community becoming more affluent, and is that a big goal for them?
Yeah, I think that from when we first came to this country, and we uneducated, and we don't have a good job, or we don't make enough money to buy a house. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're renting back. I think in 2000s, Hmong family, you know, starting buying house, and now we are, I think that about 70% of the family, you know, in the Hmong community own their own house.
Mm-hmm.
Hmong, you can see that in the last couple of years, Hmong family have business come out, like, you know, generate some business come out, and we will be continuing to grow. And I have been a realtor for 14 years, and I see that Hmong family have been a lot of family buying house. So I'm really happy that this is community is a town of the Hmong family in the community. And we are part of the community now. That's why we enhance the younger generation to continue working with the white population to understand that here is our home. Here is a place that we to live.
Yeah, you're really putting down roots when you throw in that mortgage, that 30-year mortgage.
Yes.
Let's talk now about the Hmong Studies Initiative. There's an effort underway at UW-Eau Claire that's unique to our area. I'm still trying to figure out whether it's unique to the state, but students and faculty there are working together in an effort to create an interdisciplinary Hmong Studies program. Chua, who are the people who pushed for this? Was it faculty or was it the students?
I think it's a mixture of both. But this Hmong Studies Steering Committee will be starting out this. Well, it started in the summer, and then we'll be going to for two more year for 2 years as the chancellor has appointed. But it can continue. Prior to the Hmong Studies Steering Committee, there is a group of students with faculty advisors, and the drive of this group is mostly student. It's called Hmong Studies Initiatives, and this group has been started for about 2 years since I've been in the university, so like 2011 or so. And initially, they wanted to push for Hmong language courses and Hmong content courses, so Hmong history culture courses. Those are the two that were originally offered at the university. But because of numerous efforts, it wasn't really approved through the university for fundings to go. So the class weren't run, and the language course was taught every other year. And so because of this, students continue to push for and continue to make up plans or proposal to get fundings for this for Hmong Studies program. And what really drove the to create the steering committee is the incidents on 8th floor, the one towers where the posters were posted. That was a strong signifier that racism still exists and people are still unaware of the Hmong community here in Eau Claire. And so because of that huge push, the multiple students and faculty continued this discussion and push for the steering committee in order to see a Hmong Studies proposal or a program.
So then I guess the question of why it's needed, the incident on the 8th floor is example. But before, you said there were just a few language classes. Otherwise, was it just kind of glanced over, the Hmong history in other classes, in other Asian studies classes?
Yeah, I think there were only one courses that actually brushed over Hmong history, but that was like, 2 days? Worth of teaching about Hmong history. Okay. And so I think that was,
Now, Ari, what is there any plans for what this program will look like, or is it still in the very early stages and you haven't gotten that far yet?
It's still early stages. We have a sort of, mission would be too strong a word, but a sort of remit that was given to us by the outgoing interim chancellor who appointed this committee. And he was actually largely responding to student concerns. Chua's actually being a little modest here when she says this was and there were faculty involved in helping out, but students really took the lead on this. I mean, this is really comes out of the passion and the work of the students on campus.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a few major things that the administration has asked us to do as part of this steering committee. The first is curricular development. We want to develop a fuller Hmong Studies curriculum. So courses increase our language offerings, at least make it more frequent than once every 2 years. And these courses are completely oversubscribed. Whenever they're offered, they're overflowing.
Mm.
And language courses are the kinds of courses you can't have huge courses. I mean, they're ineffective. You have to have smaller courses. So that means you have to teach them more often. And then culture and history curricular material as well needs to be developed. In addition to curricular development, our aim is to have a conference or workshop in Hmong Studies annually, at least over the next 2 years, a community outreach event, an annual community outreach event, and then a speaker series. So these are sort of some of the major components of what we want to get going. But the eventual aim is to have a Hmong Studies program that is prominent and that makes UW Eau Claire, you know, a good place to go to for Hmong American students who want to, in some sense, get the kind of structural institutional support to learn about Hmong history, Hmong culture, Hmong tradition, and so on.
Would this be a first for a UW campus, or I would think maybe Milwaukee and Madison would have something like this?
There are other programs. So Madison, for instance, has, in collaboration with the University of Minnesota, they don't have a Hmong Studies program as such. They have a broader Asian Studies program within which they have some offerings in Hmong Studies, language and culture offerings. Milwaukee has a certificate program in Hmong Studies. I believe Green Bay has a Hmong Studies center that offers some resources, but not really a full-fledged academic program.
Okay.
So there are a few other initiatives within the state. And then, of course, if you go into Minnesota, eastern Minnesota, so in the Twin Cities, there's Concordia mm-hmm. that has a fairly extensive Hmong studies program.
Right. Now, there, it seems there are two different groups on campus, the Hmong Studies Steering Committee and the Hmong Studies Initiative Student Committee. What's the difference? And maybe, Chua, you'd like to take that.
Sure. The Hmong Studies Initiative, that is the one that composed of students. And these students are students who are interested in pushing for Hmong studies on campus. And there are four representatives in the Hmong Studies Initiative, let's call it HSI. And those four are the student representatives within the Hmong Studies Steering Committee. So the HSI pretty much helped drove for the HSSC. And so now the HSSC, which is the steering committee, has been created. Most the HSI student representatives are part of the HSSC. So that's kind of the difference.
Okay. Well, we're going to take our final break here on the west side. We'll come back, talk more about the Hmong Student Studies Initiative, and we'll take some calls if you want to dial in. The number is 1-800-228-5615. We'll wrap up the discussion when we return. This is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rich Kramer. You're listening to the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in this Monday morning. Right now we're talking about the Hmong Studies Student Initiative, or Hmong Studies Initiative at UW-Eau Claire. The broader context, we're talking about the Hmong community in western Wisconsin, the history, the challenges, we're just trying to learn and further some cultural understanding here. We have got a panel of guests, including John Lohr, president of the Eau Claire Area Hmong Mutual Assistance Association, Chu Zhang, recently elected to the Eau Claire Area School Board, Ari Anand, he's an assistant professor of anthropology at UW-Eau Claire, working with the Hmong Studies Initiative, and Chu Zhang, a student representative, one of the driving forces on the Hmong Studies Steering Committee. The number is 1-800-228-5615. We have still got time to take a question or a call. You can also post something on the West Side Facebook page. I don't see anything at this point. I can't help but ask about economics and budgets and everything like that. And with a project like this, to create a whole new curriculum or a whole new interdisciplinary program, right now it seems like a really tough time to do that because of the budget cuts, massive budget cuts that we've seen. I'll put this to you, Ari Anand. Does that mean, these budget cuts within the last biennium and this biennium, is that basically going to put this on hold for a while, or are there other funding sources that might be able to, because I would imagine teachers would need to be hired for something like this.
This is a really good question. Let's see. We've been given a sort of modest budget for the next 2 years that the administration is committed to put on a workshop, to bring in speakers. It's nowhere near what you would need to hire even a single full-time faculty member. So for now, part of our goal is to see what sort of, do an inventory. What sort of resources do we already have on campus? What can we draw on to offer at least a modicum of coursework, et cetera? But our long-term goal eventually is to have a full-time hired position, hopefully. This is something that's going to be reevaluated after 2 years. So, if we can, if the program can justify over the next 2 years, if the committee and the work of the committee can justify over the next 2 years that, yes, there's a demand for this, there's good work we can do on this campus, then that would be the next step. But at this point, the university, of course, is not going to commit to the kind of money it would take to actually hire an actual full-time position.
Is that something that maybe, funding could come from the Blue Gold commitment to the differential tuition? Although I think there is also a cap on that in this latest budget.
Yeah, there's a cap on that, too, in the latest budget. So I think funding sources are up in the air. One of the things we've started on, we've actually started an account through the UW-Eau Claire Foundation for, to try and elicit support from donors. So anyone is welcome, actually, to contribute, to donate, to specifically the Hmong Studies Fund through the UW-Eau Claire Foundation. And any money going into that then would support this initiative.
And Chua, what is the overall goal here? I mean, it might be pretty obvious, but what would it mean to the community or to the campus? And what are you hoping to get out of this?
I think generally just to kind of get our name out there, just to recognize that there's Hmong here, and Hmong people are not just immigrants, but they're refugees, like we said earlier. There's a difference in the way that they interact, the way that they represent themselves, and that is much needed. Yes, you can be interested in talking about Hmong people, researching about Hmong people, but you can't go about without the correct protocols or the correct level of representation, or just so that you're not rude to the community. So I think that putting it out there and having it academically recognized will really put some prestige in Hmong studies.
And for the community as a whole in Eau Claire, what would it mean, Chujiang, to go ahead, Chu?
Okay.
What do you think this would mean for Eau Claire?
This is going to be a benefit for Eau Claire, and even more for the Caucasian counterparts, because they also need to know how to navigate this community, being that the Hmong population is the biggest minority group here. Mm-hmm. Wherever you go, you're going to probably end up working with somebody, right? And if you don't know how to navigate or just talk to that person or how to show him, you know, courtesy, how that, why he doesn't or she doesn't look at you in the eye when they're talking to you, that is actually a sign of respect in the Hmong culture. If you don't know how to navigate these things, you're not going to be successful at that job. Right, so this is going to, and going back to the language, right, the majority of the people that come down to the HMAA that asks me about a language class or a language, anything to do with Hmong, are usually Caucasians. And these are the people that know, if I know this language or if I know how to navigate this culture, it's going to be a benefit for me in the future. Right, and most of them are Caucasians. You know, so it's going to be, this is going to be a benefit to our community as a whole, not just the Hmong community. A lot of people mistaken my intent when I go out and I teach about Hmong community, it's for my own benefit.
Right.
It's not. It's for the benefit of everybody in my community.
Yeah. And John Lohr, what about, do you think that it would help foster, as Chu was mentioning, would this help the white community more so than...
Yeah, the reason I say that will help the community because many nowadays is many of the employer Hmong people is very good worker, but the language, they don't speak much in language, they assume that they are not a good worker, mm-hmm. or they were not listening. In the culture, respect people is differently in the Hmong family and the Caucasians. So if we can have this, class teaching at the UW system and educate the people, the younger generation, one day because it's the population growing up, and then we'll have more white people will become a employer or a higher Hmong employee. And they understand it, that they are a good worker, but they cannot communicate the way they're supposed to be. And that will help in this community growing up, because we are growing up a population in this community. So,
and Ari or Chua, if someone wants to become part of this and in advocating for it or maybe helping with financial support, whatever, how can they take part in this studies, this Hmong Studies initiative?
They could contact us. We don't have a website up yet. Things are sort of slow when it comes to technology, apparently, sometimes. And so we're in the process of setting up a homepage for the steering committee. And once that's up, there'll be contact information. But I'm always available to be contacted. My email address, you can look me up on the university webpage. It's Ari Anand. My email address is ANANDAS@UWEC.edu.
Okay. We've got a caller. Let's take our first caller, and probably the last one, because we're very close to the top of the hour. But we are going to hear from Carol in Mondovi. Carol, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hi. For the last 15 or so years, we had foster boys who were Hmong. And for the most part, they really didn't know anything about what their parents did and how they got here, why they got here. And I just wondered if there's something that will be written down so that the younger boys or the younger kids will understand how their parents got here, why they got here. We had to explain it to them. And when they left here, they were teenage boys. When they left here, they did have a better understanding and as to why their parents came here. I'm not quite sure. I did tune in late, so I'm just wondering if there's a way that the younger generation is now learning what their parents did.
Okay.
In order to get here.
Let's put that to Chu Zhang first. Okay, a foster situation. You don't have that father to go talk to directly. What are some of the options for Carol and her boys?
Well, Carol, it's very unfortunate, but it's something that happens all the time in my community because you don't have that time to spend with your father or if you don't have a father anymore. So these kids are not getting the education that they need. And I understand that because I was pretty much in the same shoes. My father is still alive, though, and I could learn now. But it's very late, and, you know, when I was growing up and going to school, it was uncool to learn about my culture. And so I didn't do it. It wasn't until after the military where I was mature enough to realize that this community of mine, this culture of mine is unique and it's cool. This is when a lot of us are learning about our culture, and I think that the initiative from the university is going to help this because they're going to be coming up with curriculums and histories and things like that to put on the books, as you were mentioning earlier. So I think this is going to help kids, you know, like your boys there.
And very quickly, John Lohr, would maybe boys in this situation be able to go to the Hmong Mutual Assistance Association to try to get some knowledge?
Yes. Carol, thanks for your comment. But we are the Hmong organization, Hmong Mutual Assistance, you know, Claire, and we have a book in there. And if you need your boy need any help relating to history of Hmong, feel free to contact us and you can feel free to bring him or her there, so it should be fine.
All right. I wish we had more time for this discussion, but that is our time. Carol, thanks for the call, and thanks to my guests for their discussion this hour. John Lohr, president of the Eau Claire Hmong Mutual Assistance Association. Chu Zhang, good luck with the school board. And Chu Zhang and Arlie Anand, I'm sure we'll hear more about the Hmong Studies Initiative in the days to come. I'd also like to thank Team Westside for helping put this program together. They include Mort Cypress for handling on-air production, Chia Vang for producing this program and wrangling our guests. Nice job. Thanks a lot. Hillary Crizan for promotions, and Dean Collenbeck and Tiffany Coggins for keeping the wheels greased. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for a discussion about sex trafficking. Until then, have a safe and productive week. We'll chat again on Monday.